Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the January 15th reading of the environment. My name is John. Today, we'll share the following main articles. Grizzly bears saved. The Biden administration secures the short-term future for grizzlies in the Northern Rockies. We'll also share the following article. Survivors of climate change-related tragedies demand accountability. And then finally, time permitting, mushrooms capture the imagination, and here's why. So let's get back to our first article with grizzly bears. Grizzly bears saved, written by Lindsay Botts. Grizzly bears remain protected, for now, in what is likely President Biden's last major wildlife decision. His administration announced on Tuesday that it would keep grizzlies listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The bears have not returned to 98% of their historic range, which includes five recovery areas across Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, and Washington State, a fact that was critical to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's decision. In addition to keeping the bears listed, the agency denied state requests to create separate distinct population segments, which would have divided the region's bears into different recovery groups. Instead, the agency created one single distinct population segment, which combines the populations of grizzlies spread throughout the Northern Rockies. Lastly, federal wildlife managers amended an ESA provision called the 4D rule that grants states more autonomy in managing bears, such as allowing states and landowners the ability to use lethal measures to deter bears from livestock or personal property. This reclassification will facilitate recovery of grizzly bears and provide a stronger foundation for eventual delisting, Martha Williams, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service's director, said in a statement. And the proposed changes to our 4D rule will provide management agencies and landowners more tools and flexibility to deal with human-bear conflicts, an essential part of grizzly bear recovery. The decision comes roughly 3 years after governors from Wyoming and Montana submitted petitions to remove grizzlies from the ESA, which would return management to the states. With approximately 1,700 bears across the Yellowstone National Park and Glacier National Park ecosystems, state leaders argue that grizzlies have met recovery goals in these areas. These numbers are based on the Grizzly Bear Recovery Program assessment, which says there should be at least 500 bears throughout the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem and at least 800 in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem abutting Montana's Canadian border. In its new analysis, the Fish and Wildlife Service took the view of independent scientists and conservation advocates who say that recovery is about much more than numbers. It's not just a numerical calculation. It's also about bears fulfilling an ecological role in larger ecosystems where populations are connected and there are opportunities for genetic exchange. Consequently, conservation groups have largely hailed the ruling as a success. We applaud the Fish and Wildlife Service for following the science and keeping grizzly bears protected. Drew Caputo, Earth Justice's Vice President of Litigation for Lands, Wildlife, and Ocean, said in a statement, "The best available science shows that grizzly bears are not recovered, and the states have a demonstrated record of failing to manage grizzly bears responsibly." Why grizzly recovery is important. The recovery of grizzly bears in the lower 48 states has been slow and unsteady. The population has gone from several hundred in the 1970s to about 2,000 today. That may sound like a lot, but adding a few hundred individuals over a 50-year period means that the bears are struggling to find a foothold. An uptick in deaths due to disease and overhunting could set back recovery efforts by decades. One reason for the slow population growth is that grizzlies face a gauntlet of threats. Chief among them, said Christopher Servine, a former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's grizzly bear biologist, are conflicts with people. According to the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee, 85% of grizzly deaths are caused by people through poaching or unintentionally killing. Last year was one of the deadliest years for grizzlies, with at least 90 human-caused bear fatalities, including the most famous grizzly in the world, who was struck and killed by a car outside of Yellowstone National Park. In addition to fulfilling a moral duty to restore an iconic predator, conservationists see grizzly restoration as a win for other species lower on the food chain. Due to their need for large areas, grizzlies are an umbrella species, meaning their expansive habitat usually protects other species. They are also a keystone species that keeps ecosystems in check through predation, which keeps grazing herbivores like elk on the move. Grizzlies are also special to indigenous peoples, who often center them in their histories, traditions, and ceremonies. In 2016, a coalition of 170 tribes from the U.S. and Canada formed the Grizzly, a treaty of cooperation, cultural revitalization, and restoration. At the time, tribal leaders were responding to the Trump administration's efforts to delist the bears from the ESA. Instead of completely delisting bears and handing management over to the states, the tribes suggested a co-management strategy that would include traditional ecological knowledge. Some projections show that the grizzly in the north could be on the verge of extinction in as few as 50 years, said Chief Stanley Greer, chief of the Piikani Nation and president of the Blackfoot Confederacy Chiefs. The crown of the continent is the heartland of the Blackfoot Confederacy, and we will not stand by and watch our ancestors' legacy pass into oblivion with the sacred grizzly bear. The future for grizzlies. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services considered 5 metrics to assess the status of grizzly bears: quality of habitat, human-caused mortality, disease, adequacy of conservation laws, and natural threats. Conservation groups say that states have failed to address many of these issues. One of them, in particular, regulatory mechanisms to ensure a species does not approach extinction, has proved challenging to sort out. In their management plans, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming have taken a view of recovery that creates de facto open zoos, where bears are moored in and around national parks without much room to roam. Hunting and trapping, which would be expanded under state management, would cut off any chance of bears naturally dispersing or connecting with other populations. Western leaders who support delisting lambasted the decision and vowed to continue efforts to return grizzly management to states. We look forward to working with the incoming Trump administration to explore a new path forward, Greg Gianforte, Montana's Republican governor, said in an Instagram post following the announcement. Together, we will return the management of the grizzly bears to the state of Montana and protect our Montana way of life. Meanwhile, conservation groups and researchers hope that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services will develop a new management plan for grizzlies, which could take years to finalize. The most recent plan is 30 years old. A chief proponent of a revamp is the original plan's author, Chris Servine. According to Chris and 15 conservation groups, the agency should do more to protect grizzly habitat from sprawl and bolster measures to prevent conflicts with people. In addition, Servine says that states should commit to advancing laws that protect bears before federal protections are removed. In September, allies of Donald Trump directed the incoming president to remove grizzlies from the Endangered Species Act completely. His administration will likely attempt to deliver on that promise, but it will take time, say close watchers of the effort, which would offer the bears somewhat of a buffer. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services will need to start the years-long delisting process all over again, and it will have to show why it is changing course. Governors in western states could also resubmit delisting petitions, but that would entail a completely new 12-month finding. When there's really strong science, it's really hard for a new administration to make a legal argument that suddenly, a year or two later, grizzlies are in a completely different place, said Bradley Williams, the deputy legislative director for the Sierra Club's Wildlife and Lands Protection Program. On the congressional side, it's great because denial of petitions cannot be undone through the Congressional Review Act process. What Congress can do is attempt to delist grizzlies through legislation. The current Congress has introduced at least half a dozen bills that would partially delist grizzlies in some parts of the lower 48 states. Still, if delisting does occur, the Endangered Species Act requires the federal government to monitor bear recovery for at least 5 years, and the agency would manage the species on federal lands. The continuing role of the federal government means that calls to bolster a federal management plan would be useful no matter the status of the species. In the following weeks, the agency plans to hold a series of public meetings in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming to invite local stakeholders to provide feedback. Once the agency publishes its decision in the Federal Register, a comment period will open up when the public can weigh in. Grizzly presence is part of what makes this part of America so special, Serfine said in his report. We should choose a careful management approach that will assure the future for these magnificent animals because they are an important part of the heritage of the American West. Today's next article from the magazine of the Sierra Club was written by Dana Drugmond. Survivors of climate change-related tragedies demand accountability. How one widow is calling out the fossil fuel industry in her quest for climate justice. On an overcast autumn day, midway through the annual Climate Week gatherings in New York City, Amy Dishon sat on a folding chair on a small stage and got personal with a room full of strangers. I'm here to tell the story of how extreme heat killed my husband, Evan Dishon, taking my best friend and my life partner away from me forever, she said to the roughly 60 people assembled at the Tribeca screening room in Manhattan. Sitting beside her were three others whose lives had been upended by extreme weather events. Shanta Floyd survived Hurricane Beryl, which slammed Houston in July, killing 42 people. Melissa Whitaker saw the restaurant she owns with her husband devastated by the 2023 flooding of Mount Pelier, Vermont. Reverend Richard Joyner's farm in Conneaut, North Carolina, has experienced a whiplash of droughts and severe floods. The four had been brought together by a group called Extreme Weather Survivors, which represents the growing number of Americans who have firsthand experience of the death and damage that can come from climate chaos. Dishon, dressed all in black, told the audience how she and Evan had met. It was a classic college romance, sparked when she walked into a class on the first day and sat in an empty seat next to a cute guy. They became study partners. Then their friendship blossomed into something more. He was truly the most loving and genuine person I ever met, she said. They got married and ended up moving to Phoenix so Evan could pursue medical training as a neurologist. After four consecutive miscarriages, Amy gave birth to a girl in 2022. Their daughter, Chloe, was their miracle child. Just 3 months after she arrived, tragedy struck. On Labor Day in 2022, Evan set out at 6 a.m. on a group hike through the Spur Cross Ranch Conservation Area in the town of Cave Creek, just north of Phoenix. It was a long hike, Dishon recalled, and the group had planned to be out for most of the day. A heat warning was in effect. The temperature would eventually hit 109. Several hours into the trek, someone in the group suggested they turn back, but they forged on. One of the hikers started to get cramps in his legs, and a friend remained with him in the shade while Evan and several others summited Elephant Mountain. They planned to check on their companions later. Then things quickly went wrong. They got lost, and they ran out of water. One of the hikers started hallucinating. Evan realized that they were in serious danger and needed to call for rescue. but they were out of cellular range. Evan began stumbling, then passed out. Another hiker moved him into the shade, stayed with him for a bit, then went to find a pocket of cell service. By the time the rescue helicopter arrived, Evan had died from heat stroke. He was 32. When Dishian got the phone call from the local hospital later that day, she went into shock. The feeling would last for a long time. "It took me a year for my brain to even understand what had happened," she said. "I had to reorient to a new reality that did not make any sense to me." Dishian told the audience, "It's important for me to say, heat does kill. Even a young, fit person like Evan is not immune. Our planet is warming, and more deaths are coming." According to data from Arizona's Maricopa County Department of Public Health, the greater Phoenix metro area recorded 425 heat-related deaths in 2022. The following year, that figure rose to 645, an increase of over 50%. Heat-related deaths in Maricopa County have been increasing each year since 2015. Dishian now lives in Salem, Oregon, where she and Evan grew up. The stay-at-home mom told the audience that her daughter, a red-headed toddler, has become her reason for living. Though still feeling jet-lagged from the flight to New York the day before, Dishian would be returning home that night to get back to her. When asked why she thought it was important to travel across the country to share her story, Dishian had a ready answer. "I want to make a difference, and I want to help save lives," she said, mindful of how outdoor recreation has become more dangerous on a rapidly heating planet. Dishian also has a larger aspiration. "On a bigger scale, we're seeing these heat waves getting more intense and more frequent," she said, "and I'm hoping to affect policy." She told the audience bluntly, "I hope that our government gets out of bed with the fossil fuel industry." She would like to see the major fossil fuel companies held accountable for their role in the climate crisis, especially given the evidence that they knew long ago about the dangers of their products, yet lied to the public about the risks. 100%. It's important to hold them accountable," she said. Chris Coker co-founded Extreme Weather Survivors in 2024 after previously leading networks of gun violence survivors, and he said that he's seen firsthand the power of personal storytelling in supporting healing and advancing policy changes. "We believe truly that stories are the things that build movements, that change lives, and that build political progress," Coker told the audience in Manhattan. For her part, Dishian emphasized the need for people to come together across political divisions to address the threat of climate change. "I hope that by telling my story, I can begin a conversation about how we as a community can create political will on both sides of the aisle to stop climate change in its tracks and save us from needless suffering and lost lives." And for our third main article, "Mushrooms Capture the Imagination, and Here's Why." "Fungi Are Having a Cultural Moment," written by Isabel Whitcomb. We have ways of eating our lovers. I like mine over rice with vegetables and a hint of balsamic vinegar. That's how Catherine Harlan opens her short story, "Fruiting Bodies," in the book by the same name. A pair of lovers explore their romance in a decidedly unique way. One grows mushrooms all over her body for the other to cook into delectable dishes. Swiss brown mushrooms over pasta, button mushrooms with zucchini and carrots. In Fruiting Bodies, mushrooms nurture. They foster connection. The fact that the main character grows death caps behind her knees and truffles on her chest is not body horror. It's romance, and it signals a cultural shift. For centuries, we've treated fungi with fear and disdain. Now they carry very different connotations: connection, transcendence, resistance, even hope. My mushroom fascination started with wonder. The first fungus I foraged was a hen of the woods when I was a homesick graduate student living in New York City for the first time. I ventured out of Manhattan with a group of mycophiles for a class project. The loamy aroma of the New Jersey forest reminded me of my home state, Oregon, and I delighted in the bizarre shapes and colors of the mushrooms popping up through rotting leaves. A photo from the day shows me in a raincoat, beaming, my arms overflowing with a white fungus's frills. I was hooked. I hung giant botanical prints of fungi around my apartment and devoured information on the zombie fungus, macabre mushrooms that take over the bodies of insects. I traveled upstate to meet amateur mycologists and forage, taking photos after photo of my finds. Once, a date asked me what I focused on in my work. When I said mushrooms, he gave me a long stare, then busted out in laughter. I recounted the experience to a friend. "You cannot bring that up on first dates," she said, chastising me. At some point in the past 4 years, I noticed my newfound enthusiasm was part of a larger cultural trend. My fungi fascination started earning me social cachet. Friends began complimenting my artwork and asking me if I could teach them to forage. When I described my chanterelle lasagna, a new acquaintance practically swooned. Something had shifted. Throughout popular culture, mushrooms were springing up like, well, mushrooms. Fungi cropped up in home decor and at New York Fashion Week in 2021. Enrollment in mycology courses was on the rise, as were mushrooms-related calls to U.S. poison control centers. They appeared on Netflix in Have a Good Trip and Fantastic Fungi, in Sylvia Moreno-Garcia's best-selling novel, Mexican Gothic. For much of Western history, at least among Anglo-Saxon cultures, mushrooms were seen as dirty and vile, partly because of their potential to cause illness, but also because they were gathered and eaten by malign social groups. In the 1633 book, The Diet of the Diseased, Puritan physician James Hart wrote that the French ate the excrements of the earth, the slime and scum of the water, and superfluity of the woods, and putrefaction of the sea, to wit on frogs, snails, mushrooms, and oysters. In Christopher Marlowe's famously anti-Semitic play, The Jew of Malta, written at a time when Jewish people were banned from living in England, the titular character lived upon pickled grasshoppers and sauced mushrooms and never put on a clean shirt. Mushrooms' reputation of being filthy or even dangerous persisted for centuries. Mycologist R. Gordon Wasson popularized a term to describe Western culture's disdain, microphobia. Growing amid decay, springing up seemingly at random, mushrooms represented a threat to order. In some ways, how we talk about mushrooms still carries a tinge of threat. In recent years, they've become a horror trope. Fungal spores drift through the air of a sinister parallel universe in the Netflix series Stranger Things. HBO's The Last of Us brought the zombie fungus into the spotlight, presenting a future in which these creepy mushrooms infect humans, causing an apocalypse. These depictions reflect a different kind of anxiety, worry about the collapse of society as we know it, the degradation of our environment, and looming resource scarcity. Only now, mushrooms also possess a hopeful allure. We're learning that they can digest plastic, thrive on oil, and help forests draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. In Fantastic Fungi, actress Brie Larson, a self-proclaimed mycophile, narrates gorgeous time-lapse footage of bioluminescent mushrooms pushing up through the ground and opening their umbrella-like caps. The answer to our greatest problems might be hiding right under our feet. At a time when 1 in 3 young adults in the U.S. feels lonely, and the average American spends 90% of their time indoors, part of fungi's allure is the promise of connection. In Fruiting Bodies, it's a connection between lovers. In the book Finding the Mother Tree, it's connection to something greater than ourselves. Ecologist and writer Susan Simard describes how fungi form a network beneath forests, allowing trees to communicate, share resources, and nurture one another. To imagine these interspecies communication among a society of organisms that many humans don't even consider sentient is akin to looking up at the stars and imagining life elsewhere in the universe, fantastical and awe-inspiring. Perhaps it's this yearning for connection that is fueling the current psychedelic renaissance. Between 2018 and 2021, the number of young adults using psilocybin, aka magic mushrooms, and other hallucinogens, aside from LSD, nearly doubled, according to a survey of more than 11,000 people published in the journal Addiction. Books and television shows tout these substances as an answer to the growing prevalence of despair and disconnection. In the Netflix docuseries How to Change Your Mind, based on the Michael Pollan book of the same name, colorful visuals illustrate Kathleen Crawl's experience with psilocybin as she sees herself connected across time to her ancestors, to the Virgin Mary, to her younger self, and to her past traumas. "Often, I just sit there and experience what there is in the present," she says in an interview. "There's an opening up to nature and people and life." We know that psilocybin makes the brain more plastic or changeable and opens up users to profound perspectives. In a world that can feel hopeless, mushrooms promise transcendence. And that's our time today. Thank you so much for joining us for the January 15th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.